One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome indeed, if it's your first time, to Catch Up with Louise McSharry. I'm Louise McSharry, and I am so delighted to welcome you to this podcast, which aims to catch you up on the week. If you have been busy, if you haven't been able to check in with the news or the celebs or indeed what's going on in general, no problem, babes. We all have weeks like that. And that's exactly what I'm going to try and do for you over the course of the next hour or so. We've got a great interview this week. Yes, that's right. Television's Dermot Bonan is our guest this week, which I was delighted about. I love talking to Dermot. He's so smart and fun. And I think you'll really enjoy that chat. And then, of course, we'll talk celebs, the Golden Globes, all the latest to later on. But first, how was my week? My week was fine. I don't know. It's January. Do you know what I mean? It's a slog. I'm not going to lie. I'm not loving it. I would like to fast forward to the brighter days, but I have noticed that there's a bit of a countdown happening on my phone. And it said that, this is on Twitter or something, in 39 days, it will still be bright at 7 p.m. 39 days. It'll still be bright at 7 p.m. I'm living for that. I just feel like everything is going to get easier and we're all going to be happier and it's all going to be okay. Just need that sun to just stick around a little bit more. Anyway, maybe things are much brighter in your world. And if so, I'm so happy for you. If you are one of the people who listens in Australia or New Zealand, I hope you're enjoying your summer. Wild to think that you could be walking on like a sunny beach listening to this while I am sitting in my sitting room. I'm not in my sitting room. That's a lie. I'm sitting at my kitchen table, like genuinely freezing and wearing like 5 layers of clothing. Science, eh? Never fails to fascinate and entertain. All right, let's get into it. This week, as always, we are catching up in the news with Carl Kinsella of thejournal.ie. Well, Carl Kinsella, I am sitting here wearing my wearable blanket that I got on a press trip last year, which I have been wearing constantly for the last 2.5 months.
Lovely.
But I just realized as I was complaining about being cold before I came on here that it's probably even colder in Amsterdam, is it?
It is. It's freezing. I'm not sure what the temperature is in Dublin, but I know it's been like -1 during the day here. So it's been like freezing. I'm actually kind of comforted by it because sometimes I get like climate anxiety and I worry that it's never going to be cold ever again.
Okay.
So yes. Sometimes when it's cold, I'm like, yeah, you know what? This is good. January should be cold.
Yeah. I actually kind of said that to someone the other day. I think it was like a taxi driver or something. I was like, well, you know, it was about time. Like things are pretty warm there for a while. And now I'm like, no, I'm finished with that now. And so according to the Apple weather app on my phone, it's 2 degrees in Amsterdam currently. And 7 degrees in Dublin. Oh, so it's practically balmy here.
Yeah, wow. God, 7. You guys are having it lucky. And I don't know what it is about. You know the way certain cities, it can kind of feel colder than it is?
Yeah.
I had, funnily enough, I also had a taxi driver to me the other day say that Amsterdam tends to feel colder than it is. I'm not sure what the explanation is, but I believe it because I am cold.
I visited Amsterdam once in January and it was, yeah, Baltic. It's almost like it's a lot of hard surfaces or something. I don't know. I don't know how to explain it.
I just come up with like fake science, like because there's so many canals.
Canals,
a lot of water. That could do do it.
Gotta be that. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's get into the news. As I was just saying to you before we came on, things have kicked off in The Hague in terms of South Africa taking the case of genocide against Israel. That's happening as we speak. So we can talk about where things are now. And I suppose what is happening, but there will probably be more news after we record. So just keep that in mind as you're listening. So what is the latest, Carl?
Yeah, certainly. So it began this morning, and I think we've had about 2 or 3 hours of it so far. So as you say, yeah, very much ongoing. But we've had South Africa have begun to present their case. So this is a case that I think a lot of people have already either read or seen summaries of online, but it's being read out now before the court, and, you know, side by side with video evidence, for example, of atrocities being committed. So if you've managed to see the live stream of it, it's been pretty powerful, pretty painful, pretty disturbing. Yeah. So far, we've had a few lawyers speak, including Irish lawyer Blinini Raleigh, who is a King's Counsel from the UK. Well, not from the UK, but she works in the UK. She addressed the court most recently, and she was saying that it's becoming ever clearer that huge swathes of Gaza are being wiped from the map. So that kind of speaks to the evidence or the language that we saw in the document, which said that Gaza is now a different texture from space. You know, if you look at satellite imagery, Gaza, it looks completely different than it looked 2 or 3 months ago. Mm. And this is part of the claim. But the claim, it contains just a lot of, so, you know, a lot of disturbing things have been read out before the court. Like 85% of Gazans have been forced to leave their home since October 7th. I think we've got something like 115 children dying per day. It's over 7,000 now. These are the claims being made by the South African government. You know, it's an interesting system that we do just have, you know, one country taking another country to court, and sort of there have been countries that have chipped in with support for South Africa's suit. Mm-hmm. Ireland is not one of them, quite notably. Leo Varadkar was quite critical of it this week. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's where we are right now. South Africa is still presenting their sort of opening statement and their full document in terms of the charges. So Israel hasn't had a chance to respond yet. There's been no dynamic so far. No tension in terms of the case. Just one side has been reading out their opening statement. So as you say, very preliminary. But this is where we are.
So lots of Irish people expressing disappointment this week over the fact that you know, the Irish government is not one of the countries supporting South Africa in terms of this, and disappointed with Leo Varadkar's comments during the week. Can you tell us a little bit about that for the people who might have missed it?
Yeah, it's been strange, and it's funny. I actually saw somebody online is keeping tabs on the countries that are supporting this case and the countries that are being critical of it. And Ireland is one of very few countries that has openly criticized South Africa's case. You know, the US have said that it's without merit. Great Britain's the same. But we would expect those countries to be very defensive of Israel. Mm. It's stranger for Ireland to come out so critically of this case. Mm. We had Leo Varadkar saying, I'll get the exact quote, I don't want to misquote him. So he said, Leo Varadkar said he would be a little bit uncomfortable about accusing Israel, a Jewish state, of genocide, given the fact that 6 million Jews, over half the population of Jews in Europe, were killed. So it kind of speaks to Leo Varadkar kind of sitting on the fence somewhat. Mm. He does not want to be party to this claim. He doesn't want to use words like genocide. And yeah, I think, you know, there's been articles written. There's one by Maeve O'Rourke this week. Mm. I've also had Ivana Bacik and Matt Carthy from Sinn Féin. Mm. Most political opponents, most operators in the political sphere in Ireland are calling on Ireland to back this case against Israel. Mm. But like Leo Varadkar has said, there's absolutely no chance that Ireland is going to express support for it.
And just to say, Maeve O'Rourke, if you've listened to the podcast for a long time, you will have heard Maeve O'Rourke on the podcast before. She's a human rights lawyer. She doesn't have any political skin in the game. She is someone who has worked tirelessly on behalf of the victims of the Magdalen Laundries and those types of places in the Irish state. She's an unbelievable woman, and I would just be on her side on basically everything. So I can understand why people are disappointed. And of course, you know, the violence has not stopped in Gaza. It is ongoing, and there's also, you know, continued unrest in the West Bank. Life is not any easier for Palestinians currently because this case has been taken.
No, and this is why it's kind of so interesting to pay attention to the cases, because as you and I have discussed before, it's very hard to get sort of have a feeling of certainty of what's taking place in Gaza. And I think that's why this document is so important, is because it really spells out in kind of clearly researched, clearly cited, clearly well sourced information about what is taking place, the numbers and the sort of the technical accusations that can be leveled against Israel in terms of their systemic approach towards, you know, killing Palestinians, destroying Palestinian homes, and, you know, what we would consider to be crimes against humanity or war crimes. So I think, yeah, that's why I would definitely recommend that if anyone has the chance to go through the document or watch the stream back from today, I really think it's very valuable, because it would, it gives you a very solid grounding in the current state of affairs in Israel and Gaza.
Just a reminder as well that if you feel compelled to, there is a march in Dublin city centre this weekend, kicking off at 1 o'clock at the Garden of Remembrance. This is part of an international kind of day of action. So marches will be taking place all over the world. And I think, you know, this is a particularly good one to go. I mean, I think it's always good to go, but this is a particularly good one to go to if you have strong feelings about this, if you're not happy maybe with the stance that the Irish government has taken in relation to this case. You know, this is a chance to make that known in another way. I will certainly be going. Okay. The Pope this week called for a global ban on surrogacy.
Yeah, this is kind of unusual, right? Because I feel like Pope Francis has developed a bit of a reputation as a very forward-thinking Pope. I know, like, surrogacy is a, you know, in the general sense can be a bit complicated, because it can happen, certainly, in situations where people are deprived of their agency or maybe being trafficked. But there's also, you know, a ton of legitimate uses of it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a situation where, you know, it is essentially just, it facilitates people wanting to have children. It's sort of a pretty, I don't know, I'm not going to call it like a no-brainer, but I think for many people, it's quite an accepted part of life. It's an accepted avenue in terms of having children. So very unusual. The Pope came out and he talked about the despicable practice of surrogacy. And sort of related somewhat to the Ukraine conflict, because Ukraine is sort of is a country where there's a lot of surrogacy takes place. So I think that maybe is how it sort of has come across his desk. But yeah, a really kind of strong, full-throated attack on surrogacy. As you say, like a ban, which is now being sort of referred to by Catholic groups in the US. You know, the US Conference of Catholic Bishops, they said that, you know, they kind of reiterated that, no, they don't believe it's morally permissible either. So yeah, after kind of sort of steps that the Pope Francis has taken to be inclusive towards women and towards LGBT people.
Yeah, this, like, I'm not like a regular Pope, I'm a cool Pope.
Yeah. No, but I mean, he is ultimately still a Pope, a Pope of the Catholic Church. And this is, you know, this is the belief system, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the words that he used are, he said, "I consider despicable the practice of so-called surrogate motherhood, which represents a grave violation of the dignity of the woman and the child based on the exploitation of situations of the mother's material needs." So a total lack of respect for the woman who chooses to be a surrogate, total lack of respect for her autonomy and personal ability to make a choice. You know, like, it's just so disrespectful. The implication is that there's the only way that this would happen would be if a woman was being exploited, which is just ridiculous. Like, you know, I personally know of people who have used surrogacy to grow their families because of infertility, I have a friend who was on this podcast who, you know, had cancer in her early 20s and would not have been able to have a child if it weren't for her sister acting as a surrogate for her. As you say, there are so many situations where surrogacy is a carefully considered and very thoroughly researched and thought through decision that someone makes, you know, for their family and in terms of the surrogate for themselves. And to kind of disrespect that ability to make your own choice is just another, in my opinion, kind of example of misogyny within the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I think anybody who looks at it and you know, has the modern view on surrogacy would see this as pretty much an anti-woman stance.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it goes back to that old trope of the sort of sanctity of motherhood. And obviously motherhood, you know, for those who want to engage in motherhood is wonderful. But, you know, it's that thing of, you know, this is what women are for.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like, we need to make sure to, you know, keep this sort of extremely constrictive traditional way of looking at, you know, women and motherhood. And yeah, it's a weird one. I feel like the Pope, he's let himself down on this one.
He He has let himself down.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, every time I'm disappointed by something like this, I'm like, well, you know, this is the Catholic Church. These are the rules of the Catholic Church. This is how they operate. So expecting them to be anything else, it almost kind of, I think, lays bare the fact that when he's doing his cool Pope act, or when they're doing their kind of, oh no, we're cool, we're relaxing, it's kind of BS. Like, it feels like PR or marketing, because at the end of the day, the Catholic Church's teachings are the Catholic Church's teachings. Okay, let's talk about Alaska Airlines. This is a crazy thing that happened.
Yeah, and this is, so I think people will think about this as Alaska Airlines. So it's you probably saw this week that a flight by Alaska Airlines that sort of the emergency door panel came off, you know, for part of the flight. Like, nobody died, but it was pretty damn scary.
Yeah, and can I you think imagine being in a plane and the emergency exit just flies off the side of the plane? I would be freaking out.
It's crazy. I think it would just, even people who have seen the image, it'll probably change their relationship with air travel.
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting is people think of it as sort of Alaska Airlines, but actually, you know, the plane is made by Boeing, right?
Right.
And Boeing have had a few kind of technical issues in the last couple of years.
Mm.
Like, there was situations where there was like, what was it? There was, you know, planes that had like a flight handling system that was, you know, which, you know, I'm not an aviator, I don't know exactly what that means, but that led to two crashes in 2018 and 2019, which obviously saw, you know, a lot of planes grounded to be investigated, and saw like Boeing's stock price totally plummet. But like, Boeing are obviously the leading supplier of planes, you know, and
you kind of need them to be on it.
Yeah, you need, there's very few jobs in the world where you just like can't make mistakes. And anything to do with air travel is one of you. Pilots can't make mistakes.
No.
People who build planes can't make mistakes. It has to, because the margin for error is absolutely zero. So it is very freaky. And yeah, there are like, I think a couple of hundred planes now downed in the US, or, you know, grounded, while this is being probed. But it's very hard. Like, it's just, you want to have complete trust in planes, and once you see an image of a plane with the sort of emergency panel on the side blown off, you know that people had to fly like that for, I think it was 10 or 15 minutes. That is just, oh God, it you know, it doesn't bear thinking about.
I will say one company that did come out of this looking well was Apple, because I saw a story of someone walking, finding a phone on the ground, phone still completely intact, screen uncracked, using the phone to contact the phone's owner, only to discover that it was in fact someone who was on the flight, whose phone had gone out the side of the plane, and the phone was absolutely perfect, not a bother. So maybe Boeing need to check in with Apple and see if they can
Need Apple planes. You know, maybe Apple need to take over the plane industry.
Oh no, that doesn't sound good either. I don't know. We just need the plane people to get back on their game.
And I honestly don't know. It is going to be tough to sort of restore trust. I do think that up to a certain point in history, I guess 10 or so years ago, Boeing would have been just such a trusted name.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely, I used to be a nervous flyer. I kind of overcame it, but I definitely like feel for anyone who's a nervous flyer at this point, because I think you'd be freaking out pretty bad.
Big time. Okay, let's move on to the UK Post Office, because I think people might have heard that there was something happening, but maybe didn't catch what was really going on there. So maybe you can fill us in.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's a new investigation into what is basically called the Horizon scandal, which is something that, yeah, totally passed me by. I guess it happened when I was a bit younger, but it wasn't something I was aware of until this week, and there was a new investigation launched. And basically what's happening is that there's hundreds of sub-postmasters in the UK over the last, between 1999 and 2015, were charged with basically stealing from their post offices, or false accounting, basically embezzling money, enriching themselves using, you know, post office money. And this is, we're talking about hundreds of people. Some people went to jail. There was one woman who was pregnant and she went to jail for 10 months accused of stealing from the post office, a sub-postmistress. And it turns out that this was all the result of a software error, which is the kind of thing that's like Black Mirror episode levels of, you know,
grimness.
We talk about like trust in companies. You know, I think any of us you know, if you're employed by any company, you trust the software being used is monitoring things correctly, and it isn't going to ever show, you know, for example, that you've stolen money.
Yeah.
And it's crazy that this has been allowed to happen. And yeah, like I said, there's a police investigation now and a government investigation, because I think the sub-postmasters who are affected by it, they want to make clear that this is not just a software error, but also a human error, because obviously this entire time they have been pleading their innocence.
Mm.
And I suppose they feel like the investigations up until now have totally failed to, you know, take their accounts into consideration. And yeah, it's a crazy story. And I think already about £150 million has been paid out in compensation. I think that's expected to rise.
Yeah.
So it's a really mad story. And there's an ITV drama about it now, which I think it's called Mr. Bates versus the Post Office.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, it came out.
I haven't seen it, but
I haven't seen it either, but it only came out a couple of weeks ago on ITV. So you, depending on what kind of streaming services you use or whatever, you might be able to still watch it, because I've heard it was brilliant. And that'll give you a good full understanding of the human impact of this situation. But it is, I mean, it's wild to think that you could just be someone innocently doing your job, and then next thing you're in prison, you're pregnant and you're in prison, and it's software, like, absolutely awful. Okay. Go ahead.
Something about the phrase sub postmasters as well, just the most British possible scandal, you know. Sub postmasters, I feel like it's a job title that would only exist in the United Kingdom.
I feel like maybe they need to look at that. It doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
Okay, and then finally, there's been a massive increase in cases of gonorrhea.
Yeah, 70% increase.
That's
and
huge.
This is, you know, I think when you see the headline, my first instinct when I see a headline like that, I always think, oh, that's because we're testing so much more now.
Mm-hmm.
And that is part of it.
Mm.
But the HSE has been clear that, like, there is an element of people not using condoms enough, which, you know, is that's something that we can all do, you know. Yes. Like that's a step we can all take.
Exactly.
For our sexual health.
And that's why I wanted to include this, just to remind people, if you for whatever reason have gotten a little bit casual about the old condom use, whether you are gay, straight, whatever your gender, if this is the kind of sex that you have, let's just remember that those condoms are necessary, because you don't want gonorrhea, my pals. That's not how you want to start 2024.
And this also, I'm like such a fierce advocate of STD testing, because I find men in particular, and when I say men, like, I think it's even more so probably with straight men or men who are kind of down the straighter end of the spectrum, I think tend to put this stuff off.
Mm.
And it is just it is such a, it's great when you get your results back and you are negative for everything. It's a huge relief. It's a really, you feel like you've done something right. You feel like you're taking care of yourself.
Mm.
So I would just, you know, I want to be so, you know, forthright in saying that, like, just do the STD testing. It's the best way to keep tabs on your own health. It's the best way to, you know, prevent, if you don't, and like STDs, you know, yes, they suck, but the stigma attached to them just far outweighs the actual issues at hand. You know, they can be treated. You will be okay.
Yeah.
So like, don't be ashamed. Go get tested and you will be happier for it. I promise.
Little reminder, you can get a free test kit at sh24.ie. That's sh24.ie. That's the HSE's sexual testing website. And from what I hear, it works really well. Whatever you say about the HSE, I hear that works really well. They'll send it out to you, send it back, you get your results quickly. That the home test kits will test you for chlamydia, gonorrhea, HIV and syphilis. Let's just have a good sexual health year, my friends. It's what I want for all of us. And Carl, I know you want it too.
Yeah, me too. It's yeah. I forgot to wear my pro sexual health t-shirt today, but next week.
Okay, excellent. Well, Carl, may you have a sexually healthy week and generally a healthy week as well. Thanks so much.
Thank you too.
Don't forget, guys, you can read Carl's weekly column on thejournal.ie at Surrealing in the Years. He also does other bits and pieces for thejournal.ie. So you can go and check it all out there. And of course, on social media, Carl, how are you getting on there?
Yeah, so on Twitter, which I'm still on Twitter for God knows why, but I'm still there at TV Crack Insula. And
I have been trying Threads and it's not doing it for me.
Oh, I haven't even looked at Threads, to be honest. Like, because I was such a Twitter diehard, you know, I was really I put all my eggs in the Twitter basket, and it really is falling apart at this point. Like, you can see, like, just nobody's there.
I know.
It's like about 12 people.
Anyway, yeah. But you are so still
I'm still there. I'm still holding down the fort, mm-hmm. which is, I think, at this point, to my shame rather than to my credit. On Instagram at carl.kinsella, which is a much nicer platform.
Wonderful. Okay, well, thank you so much. I think there are a few people in this country who are more commonly known than Dermot Bannon, who is, of course, the architect at the helm of Room to Improve, which came back on Sunday night to RTÉ1 and will continue for the next 3 weeks at 9:30 on Sunday evenings. I love Room to Improve. I would watch it forever. As you'll hear in this episode, I think the episodes are too short. I think that I could watch it every week and I would never, ever get sick of it. And I also am so fond of Dermot Bannon, and I will tell you why. You'll hear us talk about when we first met. And initially I say we met in RTÉ, and then he corrects me and reminds me that we met in Centre Parks. And we did meet initially in Centre Parks. And when we met in Centre Parks, he was so nice. He introduced himself to me. I was like, how do you know who I am? He was really lovely. But the reason the RTÉ meeting sticks out for me is because we were at a kind of, actually, kind of relevant, I suppose, to all the chat about RTÉ over the course of the last year. Obviously, RTÉ, like any media organization, has to kind of schmooze its advertisers. And so once a year, they always had an event. I don't know if they do it anymore, where they brought in advertisers and agencies, and they got the talent, using that word in air quotes, to come and like mingle and chat. And the first time I was invited to go, I was like, none of these people will want to talk to me. And sure enough, none of them did. Nobody knew who I was. Nobody cared. And that's fine. But I felt incredibly awkward because like the biggest names in RTÉ were there. Ryan Tuberty was schmoozing around the place. Like, you know, Ray Darcy, Miriam O'Callaghan, like all the big names are there. And obviously everybody wants to talk to them. And I literally did not know what to do. I was like standing in a corner on my own, essentially. And Dermot Bannon came over to me and he was so nice. We live kind of relatively near each other, and we were talking about our kids and the area, and he just was such a comfort to me on a day when I felt so like awkward and alone. And he didn't have to do that, and it was really, really kind of him, and I will never forget it. And it has, you know, always placed him in a shining light for me, aside from the fact that he's wildly entertaining and Room to Improve. So anyway, it is with that heart that I came to this conversation, and I loved chatting to him. Really interesting insight into making the series and also how we live in our homes in general. And yeah, 5 stars for me for Dermot Bannon. I hope you enjoy. Well, first of all, how are you doing? This is probably a very hectic time for you, is it, when things have just kicked off with Room to Improve?
Yeah, this. I suppose we're finishing off all the projects, and people think that the projects are done months and months in advance, and we don't have that luxury. It's like you're literally kind of finishing them a couple of days before they go out on air. So it's, yeah, this is a very stressful time. We still have 2 left to finish, and we've only got 3 episodes left to go out. So you can see how far behind we are.
Yeah. And so when you say projects, do you mean like in terms of the edit and like recording VO and stuff, or do you mean the literal houses?
I mean the literal houses.
Okay. Wow.
If it was just the edit and the recording, the VO, that would be an easy bit. Yeah, no, the houses are kind of finishing up, and everything, like anybody who's ever done a house, ever has, nobody's ever finished ahead of schedule. Very few people have finished on schedule. Anybody who's ever done any kind of work to their house, they've gone over by a couple of weeks. The problem is that, and that happens in Ireland, so we have them all planned. We're going to be finished at the end of November.
Yeah.
And before you know it, that becomes the end of December. Mm. And 4 weeks in a building project is not a huge amount. And it always gets a bit hairy at the end as we're trying to kind of race to the end of it. And that's where we are at the moment. And the show is on air and you're talking about it and you're doing publicity.
Yeah.
And you're recording voiceovers and you're watching the shows and you're giving edit notes and you're like, so it's just this time of the year is kind of pretty hectic.
Wow, I can imagine. And are you like going out, like having a look at things on site, or are you kind of working mostly remotely, or how does it work at this stage?
I'm everywhere. So because like I am at the stage now, mainly delivery boy for the builders. Like, so I will light fittings. I was out today getting light fittings for a house that's finishing. this week because the builder is just up to his neck. And look, I'm going to choose the light fitting signs. Might as well go choose them and then bring them to site, because then it's so I am everything at the moment.
Wow, I think people will love to hear that, because there may be a perception, Dermot, that you're, you know, now you're a big celebrity and you wouldn't be doing that kind of boots on the ground work. But it's good to hear that now you're still very much in it.
I'm probably more in it now than I was in the beginning, because in the beginning I used to let the homeowners do a lot, and I think as the show has got older and evolved a bit more, I think the audience wants to see, they want to see it looking as well as it possibly, you know, they want to be inspired. And I think as time has moved on, like having a big window in a house 10 years ago was inspirational enough. Mm. That's not good enough anymore, you know, because people are used to seeing that. They're on Instagram, they're on social media, they're on Pinterest. They know what a good house looks like. So you have to up your game. Yeah. Every single year, you have to show them something, or it has to look totally different to anything you've seen before. Otherwise, it's going to just look like a cookie cutter version of the year before. So because of that, I put myself under the pressure to make it different and to bring new things and to up our game every single time.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I was thinking a lot in preparation for this conversation about the way that the show has to evolve to reflect the reality of people's situations, you know, and it's been around for so long now that you have worked on this program throughout lots of different iterations of housing in Ireland. And obviously we're in a particularly difficult one at the moment. And I found it quite, I don't know, it was comforting the right word, but, you know, I enjoyed watching the first episode and seeing, you know, people who reminded me of me, who, you know, who maybe couldn't quite believe that they were going to have the opportunity to have their own house and to get things across the line, and who were worried about money and who needed the grants. Like, it was kind of nice to see people who felt relatable.
Yeah. And I think, look, I suppose generally on Room to Improve, like, you kind of, I suppose for a long time, you want to finish every part of the house. You want it to be as good as it possibly can be. And there's times when you would have persuaded them, look, guys, I think you should invest the money now, borrow it, because you'd only end up having to do it in 2 years' time, or just trying to squeeze as much out of the project. I think this year I let go a little bit of that. Like, there was rooms in last week's episodes that we never showed, like the utility room, because it wasn't finished. Mm. And I was kind of not okay with it. I was more than okay with saying, look, guys, when my parents did their house back in the 1970s, like, I remember as a kid, my dad took on a job. He went to Cairo to work in order to get a bit more money. And that was to finish off rooms in the house and to get a dining table and to get a nice couch. You know, I think the expectation now is that when you buy a house, you're going to walk. And if your friends are coming over, like, nobody's sitting on secondhand furniture. Nobody's sitting on that. Expectation is that the house should look Instagrammable.
Yeah.
If you move into it, and I think there's an awful lot of pressure on people, and we don't need to do that. Like, you know, when we bought our house, I remember I bought a couch at auction. It was £35 at the time.
Wow.
And we had it for 2 years, and we used to stock the couch that we really wanted. It was in the Sofa Factory, I think, at the time. And they had one up in Paris Court. They had a little kind of furniture showroom. And we used to go and we used to walk to the waterfall in Paris Court. And we'd go into, there was a little Avoca shop on the ground floor. Yeah. And we'd go in there and we'd go and visit our couch. And on for a year, like maybe once a month over a year, because we loved to go out there for a walk. And then they rang us and they said, guys, we know you've been looking at the couch, and I have your number here in file, and we're doing a sale, and everything that's display is going to be half price. Do you want it? And it was like, and you know something, we bought that couch, what, more than 25 years ago. Still have it, you know, and we'll always have it. It's a really nice. So I think this year I wanted to let go of the whole needing each house to be perfect and needing everything to be finished, because I think what I prefer to do is talk to people about being strategic in what they finish.
Yeah.
And kind of things like timber floors that go underneath furniture and underneath things, they will never, it's very hard to replace that. But putting a new worktop on in 3 or 4 years' time is easy enough. Like, I've often done that. I've put on a cheap worktop into my own house and then replaced it when I had the money to put in the nice stone one.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that is a far more valuable lesson for people than seeing something finished, is kind of looking at How can we strategically finish this place and do the things that are really, really important and kind of let go of the things that aren't?
Yeah, I think that's great that you've taken that approach this year, because it's tough for you, I think, and for the, you know, all the people who make the program, because obviously, you know, aspiration and inspiration, everybody loves that as well. And like, you know, we all loved watching you, you know, work on your own beautiful house when you shared that with us on TV, which was amazing. But, you know, because things are the way that they are, I just thought it was really nice to see things be just a little bit more realistic. And I loved, you mentioned the floor there, like I loved that you encouraged the homeowners this week to go for what they really wanted. You could see that she really wanted that floor, and you could see that there was value in that. And I kind of felt there was a bit of softness about you in this episode, Dermot, now that I really enjoyed seeing.
I'm quite a soft person underneath it all, remember? But I think, yeah, what I did was when it was a bit like a pressure cooker, and at that point, like, things had been distilled, and we'd reached a point where really, really, really what mattered to her was coming to the surface. Yeah. And it was the timber floor.
Yeah.
And you know, it kind of came to the point, like, I can kind of live without everything else, and I've resigned myself to that, but that is really sticking. I said, well, then, if that's what's in your heart and that's the bit that's sticking, let's make that happen and let's lose other stuff.
Yeah.
And that was all in that meeting. And I do remember in the meeting, and like, it's funny because a lot of TV shows, they have a little bit of a script, or they have a script in their head of how they want it, how they see the scene playing out.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's just a box ticking exercise. Okay, we'll get them into the room. And I know, I had no idea that was going to come out of it. And most of the time, I don't. Like, the really good storylines that we have in the show, you get blindsided and you think, what? Seriously? That's what matters to you. But that's what's lovely about it, because there's a lot of time when you're making Room to Improve, it can be really scary, because you're thinking, what are we covering here? What's our storyline? Because we spend an awful lot of time filming stuff that never gets used, because if it doesn't awaken something in them, or if it doesn't elicit a reaction, and I don't mean that like we prod them for it, but if people don't care about something, the audience is not going to care.
Yeah.
So if people are there, I'd like to put in this stainless steel wall, and they go, yeah, cool, whatever. Audience, if there's no, whereas we have to wait until we see what means something to them, and sometimes that can be a couple of months into filming, and then suddenly they say, oh god, no, I really hate that, here we go, this is now how the audience are going to relate to them and are going to react to them. So it's a really stressful show to make, because you've no idea what the show is going to be like, you've no idea what the storylines, you've no idea how they're going to react to things, you've no idea how any of that, and I suppose to do that is to wait and to be patient is really stressful, but it's worth it. It's worth it.
How hard is casting? I mean, do you even call it casting? Like, how hard is finding the people to be on the show? Because I know, like, people are desperate to work with you. We know this, but then how do you know who's going to make a good Room to Improve episode?
There's two parts to the casting, as you call it. The first part is the project. So there has to be a storyline. The project has to be interesting, has to have an interesting backstory to it. So I don't know if what they want to do to it, we haven't done something like that before.
Sure.
Or it is. So first of all, we pick the project, and so we will whittle down the people who apply for the show to the project. And then we'll kind of ascertain, can they do what they want to do, or can I, sometimes what they want to do and what they need done are two totally different things. So I kind of have to go into the project a little bit, into that, and say, right, okay, looking at their videotape and all of that, what they really need here is this, this, and this, and I don't think they can do it for their money, or I think we can do that for their money, but they're not going to get this, this, and this.
Yeah.
And so that's, and then the producers will kind of have their input into, it's not that we're looking for a certain type of characters, we just want somebody who's open and able to tell their story.
Sure.
There's no magic to it. It's just, if somebody is very quiet and they don't really want to be on camera, there's no point.
Yeah.
And if somebody overtly wants to just do this to be on camera, there's no point.
Yeah.
Because they're not going to care enough about the project. So it's to find the right project first, and then it's to find people who are, you think will go on the journey and talk about it. Because there is no show if people don't share. And if they don't engage it, that is the magic of Room to Improve. Mm-hmm. It's not me. It's them. You know, I am I'm just the constant that's there in the corner. But like the homeowners bring a new vitality and a newness and a freshness to every single episode.
Yeah.
And that's what's brilliant about it. Because it was too much me. You'd be bored of it a long time ago. People would have switched off 10 years ago. So it's
well, I'd say you're important too, Dermot. Like, let's not be overly modest.
I'm not as important as the homeowners.
No,
I'm,
I hear like, you.
They are the glue that, and they are the freshness and the vitality of every single episode. And that's why we go back week after week. If you saw the same homeowners for 3 weeks, you wouldn't watch it.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why we never do a two-parter. You know, we never do, the worst thing would be to have maybe the same couple over three episodes. It's nice to have a start, finish, middle, end, all of that all wrapped up in one, and with a nice couple that you're interested and care about them enough to want them to do well and to get through the stresses of their build.
Do you ever feel like you don't have enough time in an episode? Because that's Gordon's big complaint, is that he's like, we're in it, and then all of a sudden it's done, and he's like, I want more.
I know, and I suppose, like, yeah, maybe that's the traditional format of television, is the fact that, you know, TV is either a half hour long or an hour long, and it's 52 minutes. And, you know, you have to do your tour around the house.
Yeah.
You have to do your reveal at the end.
Yeah.
You have to do a little house visit in the middle. And by the time you minus all that away, there's probably only about 20 minutes to tell the story, which is not a huge amount of time. And you're right, though, but I think what it is, we've got used to a little bit longer format TV.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Box sets and things like that. So, like, nobody, like, if I want to watch 5 hours of Succession, I can, you know, and it's the same story continued. Whereas traditional TV is still compartmentalized into 50. Now, so are the others. They're in episodes, but they, you know, there's so many of them.
Yeah,
it's, we've got used to longer format things, which I don't know, will that start to infiltrate into TV episodes and things like that, that you can maybe have another episode if you want to watch it, and if you don't, you can go straight on to the next one, leaving it a little bit more flexible.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's scope for more flexibility within the TV format, and I would imagine that we will see that, because, you know, everything's in flux now, and I think people could, because, like, Bake Off, when they moved Bake Off from BBC to Channel 4, because of the ads, it's like in an hour 15 slot now, and I feel like an hour 15 of room to improve would be nice. Just, I'm just putting it out there. Just saying a little bit more would be nice.
I'm happy, because we have enough. The amount of footage that ends up on a cutting room floor is unbelievable.
Yeah.
So we have enough to make two or three episodes per episode. Like, those whole scenes get cut out. Like, I get to see an edit of it, and I was watching the Kilkenny episode maybe about a week and a half ago, and I went on to a radio show and talked about a whole scene. And then when she went out on air, that scene didn't appear. And I said, I wouldn't mind, but they rebroadcast that bit and put it out on their
social
Instagram
media and stuff. Yeah.
And I said, oh God, okay, that didn't go out on air.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, it's in a way, I think, as like, we're doing a podcast now, and as that's kind of slowly chipping away at radio, because I think it's a nice format. I love podcasts because it gives you an hour with somebody. It's you know, most radio interviews are 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You can get 3 points out, but I think there's a lovely kind of, I love listening to people relax and having a normal conversation, and kind of, I think you get to know the person a bit more in a longer format.
Yeah.
And you can only do that on a podcast when people can choose to listen to it.
Yeah.
If it's on national radio, you can't, it's there, you have to brook. You couldn't do, say, 8 1-hour podcasts on a radio station. It's just not going to work. But, you know, I think we're now starting to warm. I love, like my favorite types of TV programs are the Monty Dons and all of that. When, you know, when they go off and you just spend an hour. Like, we're even, there's a friend of mine, and he works alongside me on Room to Improve as well. And we were watching Monty Don the other night. I called over to his house to go through a drawing, and Monty Don was in Japan. And we were counting how many seconds it took him to kind of get down off the train and walk over, see the view. And it was something like 20 seconds. And that would never happen in Room to Improve. Yeah. I'd be over that in 4 seconds. You know, so that's slow TV.
Yeah.
And all that's what I love. And that's what I'd love to make. But obviously, like, we can't. I get told this is what we're doing, this is the format.
Yeah.
But I suppose I think we are maybe as audiences looking for something a little slower.
Yeah, and I think it would be nice. I'll send an email, Dermot. I'm sure they'll listen to me for sure.
I can't. They'll think I'm looking for more money.
Consider it done. It's on me.
You know, they're like money in RT at the moment. So
they absolutely love paying people massive amounts. Okay, I'm interested to know, you mentioned earlier the pressure that people feel to kind of have perfect houses, and I'm using air quotes. I struggle with this just as much as anyone else. Like, I think because what we see on Instagram is perfect all the time, you kind of get this false sense that everyone's house is perfect all the time, when in reality, and I know this from myself, from what I post, you know, I have one tidy corner and that might be where I stand to do my bit, but the rest of my house is in chaos. I'm wondering, are people kind of hesitant to have you over in their homes?
I don't know, actually, because if I've got to their house, I've obviously made it through the front door.
Yeah.
But I don't know if people most homes that I go to, because we don't, like, as a nation, like, I remember growing up, like, our back door was like a revolving door in our house. There was all my mum's friends came in, my dad's friends, and everybody kind of came in and sat at the kitchen table, and they didn't ring or announce that they were coming. They just dropped in.
Yeah.
And I think we've lost that a little bit, haven't we?
Yeah, like, I think so.
It's so easy to contact people now and be there in 10 minutes. Whereas we had all these surprise visitors used to just walk into the back door, and it was great because even your mum's friends, like, even though you were booted out of the room, like, you got 15 minutes with somebody new in the house, didn't you? Now get out. Now you've heard what you were supposed to hear. Get out of the room. And so I loved that about growing up in a house where the back door was always open. Mm-hmm. And because we lived in a housing estate, and we lived in a semi-deep, but we were the end house. Mm-hmm. So we had a corner. So it means that our back door was on the side of the house. So everybody walked in that way. So, you know, which doesn't really happen. So it was a bit like living in a country house.
Yeah.
Because I used to go to my granny's. My granny lived in Wexford, and my mum was a school teacher. So we'd decamp down to Wexford to my granny's house for 3 months every summer. And there was the kind of the good front door, and there was the yard. And the yard is where that was the farmyard. But everybody drove into the yard and walked in. The back door, it only ever closed really in winter. During the summer, that back door was open all the time. And I remember once the priest came up, there was a good driveway. So there was kind of like, the house was a long farmhouse, and there was the back door, which was the farmhouse door, and then there's the good door, which had a porch. And there was a good driveway up to it, and it was all divided off by farm buildings. And the priest arrived, he walked up, you could see him walking up the good driveway, and he got to the door, and he knocked on the door, and they went out to open the door, and the door was painted shut, like it hadn't been ever been opened.
I love it. That is gas.
So they had to kind of bring him out through a little door into a farm building and out in and into.
Oh, God, mortified, I'm sure.
The formality of living, that kind of... And it's kind of leading back to your question in that people just dropping in and I think we're even afraid to drop into people's houses now, because we know I'd be in a bit of a panic if somebody dropped into my house.
Yeah.
Now, I would, but my wife would. I wouldn't be because I don't care. If somebody comes in, they'll get a cup of tea, they'll get a biscuit, they'll get a bit of a chat. And I'm always really happy to see people. But I do feel that sometimes that people do feel a little bit under pressure.
Yeah.
So I would never drop into somebody unexpected. We've lost that.
It's kind of sad. I mean, I think there's a few different factors. Like, I think Instagram is a factor. I think the fact that we don't live in the same kind of communities that we used to live in, you know, people don't tend to get to live in the community that they grew up in. So sometimes there's a level of detachment, I think, that happens between people and their neighbors. And also, just a general pride or something, or a feeling that you have to have everything perfect at all times. Like, I find myself getting worried about my son's friends coming over for play dates. And like me and my mom friends have had this conversation of like, you feel like you need to kind of put on a show and have the best snacks and have the house in perfect order, because what if they go home and tell their mothers? And like, you know, the reality is I know that their mothers don't care, but there is just this pressure to be like presenting perfection, I think, in our homes that as you've referenced, that I think it is a shame.
Yeah. And I think, look, for me, like, architecture is not about that kind of clinical final layer that people think that they need to put onto a house. That there's a great quote by Charles Rennie Mackintosh, and I still have it at home. I bought it when I was in college. It's only a postcard, and I framed it. And it is, there's hope in honest error. What is it? There's hope in honest error, known in the icy perfections of the mere stylist.
So, oh, I like it.
And so it's always, you know, like that final layer, that if we don't have the right crockery, the right cushions, the right paintings in the wall. But like, for me, architecture is not that. Like, architecture is, you know, if you're doing something to your house, it's not about that kind of final layer. It's about opening it up to the garden. It's about creating opportunities so your house is easier to use, not that it looks better. That it's but if you've got a nice garden and you put a window there, that suddenly that garden, when you're sitting there by yourself, you're enjoying it. It's not about other people. It should never be about what other people think of it, and it should be about you and your family and create, and you know, and doing the functional things that will allow you to live easier in your house. Putting in storage so the house isn't always cluttered. Not about having the picture perfect storage that goes under the stairs and things slip in and out. And it's all of, you know, it's about having a dining table that's good for gathering, good for doing homework, good for, you know, but also like, I did an interview last week and we were chatting about it, and like, do you remember like the best dinner parties you were ever at were kind of when you were younger and you, sometimes even a student, and you sat on stools, you sat on benches, like you sat on other people's laps and you had dinner.
Drank wine out of mugs.
Drank wine out of whatever.
Yeah.
And you know, really, when you distill what our homes are about, it's about having enough space to gather people. And you know, because it's the people in the house, and it's the atmosphere, and it's the like music. Honestly, putting on the right music in the background can be far more effective than a 17,000 euro couch.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Allowing people just to relax and come in, and a smile on your face and a warm welcome. Come in here, sit down. I've made you a nice dinner, even if it's just a spaghetti bolognese. I think people appreciate that far more than they do, oh yeah, do you like my lovely new chairs?
Yeah.
They were 800 euros. You know?
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think I always loved going to somebody else's house and sit down there now and I've made you a nice dinner and you kind of feel a little bit looked after, you know? And that's why when somebody comes to my house, I remember, I shouldn't be saying this out loud, but like I was really, really busy coming up to Christmas and I was kind of trying to put it out to my family. Would anybody else like to host on Stephen's Day? And they're all going, no, you're right.
That's what you get for having such a nice house.
Yeah, my brother got on the phone to me and said, look, are you okay hosting? And I said, look, I am, I'm fine. Yeah. And he said to me, like, because I know the effort of, you know, having to clean up the house and get everything ready. And in my back of my house, they're, what clean up? Like, I'll be cooking food, but I won't be tidying away anything or doing like when you arrive at our house, you get what you see, and that's it. So I never would think of, I would always think of the food and the music, and if you have the two of those right, you're sorted.
Well, I think you're right. I'm interested, just before I let you go, I'm interested to know if you think the pandemic changed the way people look at their homes and what they want from their homes. Because I remember at the time, a lot of people saying, we loved our open plan space until we were all in the house all day, every day, and we couldn't get away from each other. Has there been any fallout from that, do you think? Or do you think people are going back to the way things were?
I think people questioned it. And it's, look, it's always good to question everything that you do. And I think the kind of the segregated or the contained rooms is not, I think people sought that out a little bit during the pandemic, but that's because they couldn't leave their front door.
Yeah.
You know, you could go out for your walk for 2 kilometers, you couldn't see anybody else. And I think we did all get cabin fever at a certain time. But the flip side of that is that, yes, it was annoying. Like, there's always going to be a compromise, right? There's always going to be this yin and yang with everything. Mm. So for all the people who complained about the noise, if people had been in self-contained rooms, there would have been an incredible amount of loneliness. And so, you know, I think like we've all got used nowadays to working in open plan offices and actually like it and knowing that your colleagues are at the desk next to you and can, oh, God, come here. I'm out. Like, say for you, you write. I'm trying to finish this piece and this sounds a bit naff. Do you think you know, and you'll quickly throw it over to somebody, or there might even be a group and say, oh, no, I did something like that. And I'm the same. Like, I'd say, I'll just quickly drag people over and say, look, I'm trying to do this, this and this and this space isn't working. And we've all got used to the open plan office and none of us will go back to segregated cellular offices anymore. And homes are the same. And I noticed that during the pandemic, and now we're lucky we have an open plan space and it's a nice size, but everybody was in their own corner, kind of doing their own thing. So some were doing homework. Well, I'm not going to lie. They were playing Xbox or PlayStation. Whatever.
I appreciate the honesty.
In the corner. And they were, because the kids were lucky because they had the headphones and they were able to talk to their friends. So they were able to meet their friends. Without, but so we didn't mind them being on the Xbox.
No, I think that was a godsend for them.
That was their social outlet. Mm. But they were in the same room as us. Mm. So we were all together and it was noisy. And it was, my wife did complain. And complained about the noise level. But you can't have it all.
Yeah.
And it's like everything in life. Like you can't be a working parent and be fully present at home, fully present in work and have a gym body. We've all learned that nobody can, and the same goes for your home.
Yeah,
you can't. If you want to have peace and quiet, prepare to be a bit lonely.
Yeah,
you know, if you want to have a social house where people are gathered and there's a nice social connection, prepare that there is going to be times when it's going to be a bit noisy and you're not going to like it.
Yeah.
And I think the solution to it is, and it's funny we were talking about earlier on. Sorry, going back even, I'm jumping things, but like we always had a good room in a house growing up. And that good room was what, remember the visitors used to drop in. And if somebody was a really good visitor and you didn't want to bring them into the kitchen, you had a good room to bring them to, the one that was never used and had still the plastic on the furniture and all of that. So you were safe. There was a safety net there. And I think, you know, the good room was always the safety net in the house, that if you need a bit of peace and quiet. But what I think most homes need now is a small, tiny room. And what I mean is like, you're talking about a box room and a bedroom, you know, the box bedrooms, somewhere that maybe has a desk, a TV screen or a monitor and an armchair and that you can go in and get a little bit of headspace. So dedicating a massive amount of space to another living room is, if you don't have the space or the budget for it, is a waste of time. But somewhere like each house, sorry, this is digressing a bit, but each house to me needs three different things. It needs a head, it needs a heart, and it needs a gut, right? And for it to be working purpose. So the most important part is the heart, right? And the heart is the open plan space. It's the kitchen, it's the dining, it's the family space, it's the gathering space, it's the living room. That's where we as people are nurtured, and it's where we go to be with it. The head space can be a bedroom. It can be just somewhere you need, somewhere that you can be by yourself for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Doesn't need to be a big space. It doesn't need to, you know, you don't need to take up half your house. And a gut. And the gut is, if you have a big open plan space, you need somewhere for to dry the clothes. You need somewhere to put all the boxes. Years ago, we had the good dining room. So we were able to dry the clothes in the good dining room. We were able to leave all the boxes. The Christmas decorations would still be in there in March. And, you know, so it's if you can get the three of those things right in your house, if you've got a really good heart space, if you've got a gut, which is the workings, somewhere to throw stuff, a utility room. Like I would sacrifice a study thing. I'd sacrifice a lot of rooms to have a good utility room.
Oh, same. My dream.
You've got somewhere to put all the clutter.
Yeah.
You know, because otherwise you walk into your lovely open plan space and there's a clothes horse sitting in the middle of it. There's, you know, the skateboards, the roller skates, the scooter, just somewhere to put that. I would sacrifice. I would just have an open, if it was down to distilling it down to just two rooms, I would have a utility room and I'd have an open plan space. And then if I needed a headspace, I'd go up and I'd sit in the bed.
Yeah. Sounds good to me.
Those are three spaces that people need.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we have lost our way a little bit in the aesthetics of a house and what it should like, without understanding what are our needs and what can I take advantage of on this site, on where I live? Is there a lovely view to a mountain? Is there a nice view to the sea? Is there just a nice garden? Is there a park across the way? Can I borrow a view by looking over to the green? We did that in a house last year in Lucan, where we kind of opened it up to the front of the house, which was unusual because everybody likes to live at the back of the house.
I remember that,
They wanted to overlook the green. So I kind of created these diagonal views out towards the green. So the green became a big part of the house because they loved looking at it. So it's just capturing what you have in your own house and in your own site. And making the most of it.
Well, we've three more episodes in the series. Room to Improve, of course, is on Sunday nights. I feel like it's just always going to be there. That is just when it is on RT1. What can we expect?
Every year, though, it's funny because every year I make it like it's my first series. Like I last week when I was waiting for the ratings, I was more nervous than I was in year number one. And I still, like, for the whole month of January when it's on air, like the weekends are ruined. Not because, like, it gets easier as the programs get made and the pressure gets less, but I can't sleep. I can't, while it's on air, I get really, really nervous what people think. And because I feel like I've been given an amazing opportunity. Like, there's not that many architects on television.
No.
And there's not that many people doing what I do. So I do feel kind of look, and I feel the responsibility of that, that I need to be doing the best that I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And you always worry about it then, that am I, you know, because maybe it's the imposter syndrome or whatever, that like, you know, could somebody else have done a better job? So you're always really, really nervous as to what people think about it. But like that, I've tried. Okay, it doesn't matter. It's done. It's all in the can. Whatever happens, happens. I tell myself all these mantras. You can go on to Instagram as well and find loads of mantras to say to yourself.
You absolutely can. Well, there's only one Dermot Bannon, and you know, you are so loved by the country. Like you said you feel very lucky. Like it must feel like a privilege. I mean, that must be why you're nervous. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't want to let people down, because like I've been doing this for a long time. I think I've met everybody in the country at this stage.
I think you might be right.
Well, we've met.
We met in RTE, yeah.
And we didn't. We met in Centre Parks.
Oh, we met in Centre. Well, that was our first meeting, and then we met shortly after in RTE. Yeah. Yes. No, I'll never forget the Centre Parks meeting, because you were approached by two teenage girls to take a photograph, and I was like, "You've got to be the only architect in the country who has teenage girls approaching them for photographs."
Now you see the weight of the responsibility on my. It is a privilege. It's an incredible privilege, and people are so warm and so friendly towards me, and I don't take that for granted. And And it is a nice feeling that no matter where I go, like people say hello to me, and if I walk into a garage and you go to pay for petrol or you throw a chocolate bar up in the thing, well, Dermot, do you want a cup of tea with that? With you know, it's just it's nice, and it's funny, like you were talking about your community, like I actually feel like a local everywhere now, which is really nice.
That is so nice.
It is nice, but then if you're in a bad mood, Jesus, it's like
I was going to say, it's a double-edged sword, maybe, because,
you can't put your nose walking down Grafton Street.
You certainly cannot, Dermot. You have to be nice all day, every day, and that is really something to contend with. Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate you giving my little old podcast your time. I am so delighted that Room to Improve is back. I get so excited every year when it comes back. I hope it never ends, and I wish you the best of luck with the rest of the series.
Thank you very much.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable, North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's armodillo.com, and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo. Built to last. Designed to impress.
Loads to talk about in the celebs this week, guys. The Golden Globes served up lots to talk about, even if the show itself wasn't the best we've ever seen. There was lots of gossip. What were Selena and Taylor talking about, do we think? Did Barry Keoghan's penis deserve his own seat? Yes, that came up. And lots more besides. This week, Cassie Delaney of The Creep Dive joined me to talk through the stories. Cassie Delaney, it is a pleasure to once again be speaking to you about the world of celebs. I have to say, there's loads of good stuff to talk about this week.
Oh, it's a great week. love awards season. I love it. It's where you get your goss from. It's where you get your good movies from. We get Scandal to dine out on now for like the next couple of weeks. It's going to be stunning.
It feels early this year.
Golden Globes are, yeah, like when do we, the Oscars are usually what, end of February, March?
Yeah.
We usually have a nice little gap between the two of them, but it is a straight into 2024 with an awards show is a great way to start the year.
And there were some Emmys on last week as well, like the Creative Arts Emmys, which are the, I think, like less important Emmys. Maybe I have that wrong, or maybe they just weren't such a big deal this year. But yeah, award season has begun with gusto. And we've got loads to talk about, so we might as well just get into it. Golden Globes happened. Mm-hmm. Overall, a bit of a weak show, I think.
100%. So the vibes were so off at the actual award show. So there's loads of things that have gone on behind the scenes. Obviously, the Golden Globes has changed channel. So it was like streaming on Paramount Plus. And, you know, last year we had a load of scandal with people walking away from the Golden Globes and people behind the scenes giving out about the selection process and things like that. So like the kind of the nitty gritty behind the scenes was off for a while. So this should have been a really good opportunity for the Golden Globes to come in and do like a new show, like rejig the format, get the vibes going, like just make it a fun evening. But like you can see from the look on people's faces in the room, nobody was having fun. No. Except Kylie and Timothy, but like nobody else was enjoying themselves. Like everyone was deadpan. And I think a lot of the reason is, obviously we have to address it up front, is Joe Coy's monologue was just so flat. It was not funny. It was misogynistic. It was like the low hanging fruit jokes. It was just, it was awful. It was tense. It was, even if the jokes were funny, his subjects, he was not on game. And, you know, we saw a lot of really, really weak jokes aimed at Barbie and Taylor, and just nobody was having it.
Someone on TikTok was showing how you could make jokes about Barbie and how you could make jokes about Taylor that weren't like misogynistic and bad. And like, you know, it didn't have to be like that. I'd never heard of this guy Joe Coy before this. He used to be apparently regularly on Chelsea Lately. Chelsea Handler's show. I don't know. I don't know if it's that they should just stop having these kind of monologues, or if they need to just go a completely different route and maybe not necessarily get like a stand-up comedian, but get someone who's like a funny writer or something. Maybe they would be better. Like, I feel like someone like Dan Levy would be good. Just like these of guys, or women, obviously. Although I saw it pointed out that when Tina Fey and Amy Poehler hosted, it was brilliant, but they also made a joke about Taylor Swift, which she did not like, and which they were called out for being misogynistic as well. So like, look, everybody can make a misogynistic joke. There's no doubt about that. But like, I feel like they need to take a different route.
They need to do, and I've said it once, I'll say it again, stop giving men microphones. We don't need another male presenter. Give it to Tina. Give it to Amy. Give it to, you know, Maya. Any of the staple SNL gals would have pulled this off extremely well.
Yeah.
And the thing was, they were such cheap, obvious jokes. And in the year 2024, after the year that was the Barbie year, to poke fun when we know there was that kind of like rivalry, that fun kind of like Barbieheimer, Oppenbarbie, whatever people were calling it, thing during this. I don't know, I never saw Oppenheimer, so
yeah, me neither.
Yeah, to know that they were going head to head and the Barbie triumphed. And the thing is, Barbie triumphed, fun fact, 2023, highest grossing film of 2023. The second highest grossing film of 2023 is still not Oppenheimer. It's the Mario Brothers movie, and then it's Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
So like, to be making cheap jokes and like uplifting like the men in the room again. And even when you listen to Joe's monologue, he goes around and he like, any compliments he has to give out are just towards men in the room. And then his jokes are directed at the women, except for when it comes to like Meryl Streep, and he's like, she's the GOAT, greatest of all time, and then makes a joke about, you know, her being his mother's favorite actor. And it's just like, it was like watching one of the boys trying to impress the other boys and really like make just shite jokes. Like the only funny thing he said was when he was talking to Barry Keoghan and he was like, "Where's your penis sitting?" Like, yeah, that's the real star of the show. Like,
yeah, that was funny.
I was like, I'll give you that.
Yeah.
And like, I'm probably only accepting that because Barry's Irish. And I'm like, look, an Irish man's large penis is all of ours large penis. Like, we are there doing well on the big stage.
I think for me, the real issue is that he wasn't funny. Like, you can, I think you can kind of get away with making jokes about anything as long as you're funny and as long as it's smart. And it didn't feel funny or smart or fresh. And like all of the video from the room, it seemed like people just were not laughing. And like, I've seen some people who were actually there saying, yeah, no, it was like he bombed. Gotta be tough for him. I saw Steve Martin kind of send him a vote of encouragement though on Twitter. He was saying like, you know, he knows how hard it is to do that gig. And like, you know, he didn't say you were good, but he was just like, stuff out there, buddy.
Don't and I beat
was
like, yourself yeah. up about it.
And I was like, well, that's nice.
Don't
at least
think about it. Yeah. Don't lay awake every night for the rest of your life and think about how you bombed at the Golden Globes. Now, he did talk about it on the Good Morning America podcast, What You Need to Know. And he said, look, he had fun and it's a moment I'll always remember. But he did say there was a moment where he was like, ah, this is not going well. And I'm a stand-up comic, but like it's hosting is totally different. But like the thing was, like, during the monologue, even when he could feel that things weren't going well, he started then being like, I didn't write all these jokes, and he wrote some of them and they're the ones you're laughing at. And I was like, oh, pointing the finger now at the writing team is not the way out of this situation.
It's kind of hard to think about too much. I saw Greta Gerwig was on the Today program on BBC Radio 4, and they asked her about the whole thing, and she said that, yeah, like definitely there had been some sneering at the film. She said that he's not wrong, because he says, well, you know, she said, well, you know, he's not wrong. She's the first doll that was mass produced with breasts. So he was right on. And then she basically said that that much of the movie, which stars Margot Robbie in the title role, was unlikely because it is about a plastic doll who has no character, no story, and is there to be projected upon, as in, it's fine that this man projected his personal feelings about women onto Barbie, because that's not, you know, he's proving our point, basically. She's so classy and smart.
It's so classy. And it just goes to show, it's like, that's why the work is important, babes. Yeah. That's why we need it. And the same when we panned to Taylor Swift, and he made that joke about the NFL and the Golden Globes having less cutaways to Taylor Swift than the NFL. Like, just Taylor's The Man came into my head. And I was like, that's why we uplift these women and we watch their films and make them billionaires and the highest grossing films of the year. So, and then we go back to never knowing about Joe Coy ever again.
I have to say though, like, I didn't think that joke was particularly bad. I think that was more making fun of the NFL than it was making fun of Taylor Swift. But like, you know, she obviously has a hard line about letting men make jokes at her expense, and fine, I respect it. In terms of the awards, for us, Cillian Murphy won a Golden Globe for Oppenheimer. We had like a 50% chance, didn't we, of winning in that category? Because
of an Irish person, yeah.
Yeah, Irish Scott, Andrew Scott, Barry Keoghan and Cillian Murphy were all in that category. Big winners, Succession, Poor Things won an award, which is only coming out on Friday. I'm dying to see that. Kristen Wiig and Will Ferrell were funny.
Yeah,
that's kind of the big
dying
news
to see that. Yeah. I mean, I think the Golden Globes usually give us a sort of like peak of where Oscar season is going to go, and I think that I was surprised that Barbie won for obviously box office achievement. It couldn't but have won. It was like a, you know, groundbreaking year. But yeah, I would have liked to have seen. I think there was some sort of, they expected Barbie to make it, to maybe get it for comedy. And obviously we all haven't seen Poor Things, but it looks incredible. And it's giving real, people don't want to wait. Well, it's out tomorrow. It's out when this podcast's out. It's out tomorrow. So go listen to this and go straight to the cinema. But it's real, it's giving real cajillionaire vibes, which is also a fantastic comedy with Evan Rachel Wood. And Gina Rodriguez, and it's given that same vibe, and it's one of the best films I've seen in a really long time. So
okay.
I can't wait to see it.
In terms of salacious gossip, obviously much was made of a moment in which Selena Gomez went over to Taylor Swift's table and whispered something in her ear, which produced a reaction from Taylor Swift and her friend Kaylee, who was with her. But the initial thing, lip readers were saying that what Selena was saying was that she'd gone over to ask Timothy for a photograph and Kylie had said no. But since then, Selena herself has commented on an Instagram post to say no. She was talking about two of their friends who had hooked up. I don't believe it.
I love this. I love this because she was like, no, that's made up gossip. I was talking about real gossip. Like, I was talking about real scandal amongst our lives about two people we know that had hooked up with each other. And I was like, of course they were. There's no world in which Kylie at an event like the Golden Globes would have stopped Selena Gomez from taking a photo with Timothée Chalamet. Like, that's just, everyone's grown-ups here, and they're so on. They know that that would be really weird behavior. So like, no, I don't believe that that happened. Do I believe two of their friends hooked up and they were getting good little like giddy catch-up about it? Yes.
I just
think the real gossip is always much better than the rumors.
Yeah, but also I thought that Kylie looked nervous. Like, if you saw the footage of the two of them on the red carpet and stuff, Kylie looked nervous. There's footage of her talking to Greta Gerwig with Timothy. Timothy's talking to Greta Gerwig's partner, husband, Noah Baumbach, filmmaker. And she looks nervous. She doesn't look like someone who's going around saying, no, you can't take photographs of that person.
Yeah, but I think as well, she's out of context of the Golden Globes. You know, she doesn't have her sisters around her, and she probably has not seen Oppenheimer, and she probably hasn't watched a lot of the films that are there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she probably was just a little nervous. And also it was like their first big, like really big public outing. Obviously they've been spotted together, but like a really big public outing for the two of them, surrounded by like his people and like the most famous people in the world.
Yeah. So, you'd be terrified.
Yeah, of course. There was not a world in which I would be able ever to walk a red carpet.
Like, no way.
Well,
not that kind of red carpet.
With the nerves.
Yeah. No. And especially since, like, she, if you watch the show, she's kind of shy. Like, she's not like a ball buster. So, yeah, I don't buy the fabrication. I actually don't completely buy two of our friends hooking up, but I think it was something else salacious. Staying in the world of film, but moving on slightly, we must address the candle in the room. Well, it's not in my room. I kind of wish it was. I'd love to smell it for science. Why do I want to smell it, actually? I'm just investigating my own motivations here. I'm talking about the Saltburn bathwater candle that is now available.
Yeah, so I love a scented candle, but this is one that I do not particularly, I'm not gravitating towards it. Now, obviously, love Saltburn, fantastic film. Emerald Fennell is going to do for the rest of her life, I will follow. I will walk off a cliff if she tells me to do that.
I loved Saltburn. I loved it. I loved it.
And I think I went to see it with the Creep Dive hosts, and we came out and they were like, who is Emerald Fennell? And if you go back on her history of stuff, you know, like she wrote two seasons of Killing Eve. She had this fantastic film with Carey Mulligan a couple of years ago called Promising Young Woman, which is brilliant. She was Midge in Barbie, and she's clearly building up her universe now around her in the same way that like Greta Gerwig is doing with, you know, Saoirse Ronan and her characters, whereas Greta has like, or Emerald has really taken in Carey Mulligan and stuff. And it's just fantastic. It's brilliant. And I think she's a genius. Very, very sharp. But the candle, the scented candle, the bathwater candle, just not for me. So you can buy them on Amazon and Etsy. They come in vanilla, comfort spice, or sea breeze. And
Wait, they come in three different smells?
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Depending on what you want. No, I think the sea salt one is probably the most accurate.
That's ridiculous, because then it's not actually a Jacob Elordi's bathwater candle. It's just a candle with that on it. Oh,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
Because Barry was asked if he, like, they had it on the red carpet and they were asking the people from Saltburn to smell it. And Barry said that it smelled like Jacob. So now I'm like, how could it smell like Jacob if it comes in multiple scents? I feel very let down by this information.
Yeah, I want to know which one they were smelling on the red carpet. Mm. Barry also said he had 10 already in the house. Like, he's doing a really good line and press tour here now of like doing this little flirt with Jacob and getting everyone giddy and excited. I think the thing that needs to be addressed for Saltburn is like whether you're in the category of people who thought that bathwater scene was absolutely insane, or whether you were people expecting something so much worse and watched it and you're like, oh, okay, that's grand.
Okay, so the bathwater scene didn't bother me.
Didn't faze me at all.
The bloody scene didn't bother me. I don't want to give things away too much for people who haven't seen it yet. I was shocked genuinely shocked by the final scene in the graveyard. But
yes,
I also didn't feel like it was bad or like too much or, you know, anything like that. I kind of thought it made sense for his character. Did you hear that it was improvised?
Yes, that's the thing that surprised me about it. And I was like, he is, it's just, it's stunning. People, if anybody hasn't seen it yet, they have to go watch it. And
you have to.
Imagine the conversation where Barry was like, can I just try something out here? And then did that.
But I mean, for me, that's like, what a brave actor. Like, that is a hard thing to do. But I
think
it's
very hard.
But I really think it made sense for the vibe and the character. But yeah. Wow. Yeah. Ballsy to be like, I just want to try something. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. Something's just come through my mind. Yeah. No, it's a fantastic film, though. Everyone should go watch it.
Totally agree. News about Sinead O'Connor this week, that she died of natural causes. This is the coroner's report came back and confirmed that she had died of natural causes, which is, you know, I think some people felt was comforting. I saw that her ex-partner said that, you know, the confirmation that that she died of natural causes is actually confirmation that she died of a broken heart over the death of her son.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's tragic no matter what.
It's still heartbreaking, but I think that it is somewhat of a comfort to think that she wasn't, you know, that she didn't want to cause harm to herself.
Yeah.
You know, in those days, I think. For a lot of people, that is a real comfort. It's still so incredibly heartbreaking and sad. But
And finally, before we go, Eurovision, Ireland is abuzz with Eurobuzz because they have started to announce the contenders for our Eurovision entry this year. And Erica Cody has become an early favourite.
An early favourite with an absolute bop.
Yeah.
And I think we have it in the bag. I think that we're going to send Erica off. She is going to redeem Ireland's status as peak Eurovision people. And like, it's true. We have the population. We are like so queer friendly. We're very camp. Eurovision should be in Ireland every single year. We should be triumphing. And I think sending our queen, Erica Cody, off to do our work, I think she'll bring it home. I think she'll bring the Eurovision home. And then in 2025, we will be the campus city in all of the world if we host the Eurovision again.
Oh my God. I mean, I would love it if that happened. I have to say, the other entries are interesting too. Like, the other potential Eurovision contenders are interesting too. Like, Ailsa, her song Gatobin is like, could we send a metal song to Eurovision? I kind of think maybe that would be fun. Maybe it would be fun to do something completely different. But Erica is the early favorite, and you can see why.
Yeah, it's such a bop. It's a great song. Even if it doesn't get to Eurovision, that playing now during just in a nightclub, I think I will lose my shit to it. And I'm not a dancer, as we all well know. I will be up in the dance floor for that song. I just really like it. I couldn't stop listening to it this morning. And I think Eric is fabulous.
Yeah, so I think we're all in agreement on that.
A hoot.
Well, Cassie Delaney, thank you so much. Where can people find you?
I am on the Creep Dive. You can get me there. For some weird and wonderful stories and a lot of Saltburn chat over there too.
Yeah, exactly. If you like Saltburn, you'll love the Creep Dive. Thanks, Cass.
Thank you.
Now it is just about time for me to go. But before I do, I want to give you a few recommendations. They're all films this week, actually. And I knew last week when I was doing my big film roundup from the films I'd watched over Christmas that I'd forgotten one. And I remembered it immediately afterwards. And a film I watched over to Christmas was Air. This is the film about Nike. It's about Nike kind of courting Michael Jordan and becoming a big name in basketball. It is so good. It's just a really enjoyable, like, romping along film. It's not hard to watch. It's smart. It's fun. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck are in it, and they're great in it. The whole cast are brilliant. I just could not recommend more. You could watch this with anyone. You could watch it with your dad. You could watch it with your husband. You could watch it with your wife. You could watch it with your partner. I feel like everybody would enjoy it. An easy selection. You could probably even watch it with your older kids if you wanted to on a Friday movie night. I don't know, just saying. And it's also not too long. It's an hour 52, which is more than what I want, but it doesn't feel like it. So highly recommend that. Another film that I watched last week, which just came out on Netflix last Friday, is Good Grief. And this is the film by Dan Levy, who is the guy behind Schitt's Creek. And he wrote it and directed it, and he is also in it. And a few people have said to me, oh, I kind of want to watch it, but I'm worried that it's going to be too hard, because it is about grief. It is about a man whose husband dies. But it's also about so much more than that. It's about friendship. It is about loss. It's about how complicated relationships can be. And it's just really good. It's really good. It's a lovely watch. And it's 1 hour, 40 minutes. Perfect. Ruth Negga is in it, and she is lovely in it. She plays an Irish woman, and like a contemporary Irish woman who's good crack, albeit complicated. And yeah, I just think you'll like it. Like, it's not going to change your life, but I think you will really like it. And it's not too heavy on the misery, so I wouldn't be overly worried about that either. And then finally, this is a film that I had seen before. It's not new, but it was on TV, I think. I don't know how we kind of ended up watching the second half of it this week at some stage. It just ended up on the TV, and it is so good. And just in case you haven't seen it, I thought I'd recommend it. It came out in 2019. It is a brilliant, brilliant film. It stars Riz Ahmed, who I adore. I just think he's such a brilliant actor. And it's about a drummer, a metal drummer, who loses his hearing. And you kind of don't need to know much more than that, just that it's brilliant. He's brilliant in it. It's got loads of heart. And I highly, highly recommend it. It's 2 hours long, but doesn't feel like it's a minute too long, which is not something that I can say very often. Am I obsessed with the length of films? Yes, I am. I'm obsessed, guys. It's just the reality. Now, before I go, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to those of you who joined me over on the Patreon. There's going to be two Patreon episodes going up next week, because with the rhythm of life and podcasting and all the rest, these are the first ones that are going up this year. So I'm giving you a double to make up for lost time. So I hope you'll enjoy that. We are going to be talking about Gypsy Rose Blanchard and all of the media and content that's been made around her on the culture episode. And there's also going to be a mailbag episode too, with all of your feedback and my responses to your feedback and your thoughts and your feelings, which are actually some of my favorite episodes. So don't forget, if you have thoughts, if you have feelings, if you have opinions, if you have recommendations, if there's something you think we should talk about, please do get in touch. Send us a voice note. Us, and by us, I mean me and the other people in the Patreon. It's 089-209-6423. That's 089-209-6423. And don't forget, my friends, I am coming to the Everyman Theatre in Cork. I am coming to the Everyman in Cork on February 1st, and I am so excited about it. If you live in or near Cork, please do come and join. I have a great guest. I'm going to be announcing that soon. She is wonderful. And this is St. Bridget's Day. It's a day to celebrate women. And I can think of no better woman to talk to on this day than this person who is coming. You are going to love her. She has so much to say on every section of womanhood and life as a woman in Ireland. And I really can't encourage you more to come and see it. Please do. Okay, that's all. Thank you so much to my contributors. Thank you so much to Acast for having me on the network. And I will talk to you next week. Don't forget, they can't all be good. And if it's not good, that's okay too. Just put one foot in front of the other and we'll be together again.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Flimsy stands slowing you down? Well, it's time to upgrade. Armadillo builds durable North American-made tablet stands and kiosks. We're so confident, we offer a lifetime warranty. So, elevate your business and visit armadillo.com. That's ArmOdillo.com and use code ACAST for 5% off. Armadillo, built to last, designed to impress.